What this town needs is a poetry bar. I'm not talking about that spoken word. Nah, that's joined to the hip to hip-hop. What I'm talking about is a bar that has a karaoke machine with nothing but good poems on it. You could just use an overhead projector, Bobby. Sabatini shook his head. Nah, I want something flashier than that. I want beautifully letter-pressed broadsides projected onto the screen. I want atmospheric music in the background of each poem. I want a place where a guy would feel safe and cozy reading Theodore Rethke poems through the speakers. I liked listening to Sabatini rap and saw it as a public service. After all, I was one of the few people he could let his hair down with, strutting around as a poetry proselytizing police detective is a delicate proposition. Sabatini stood up and started pacing. Can't you see some large-lunged dude coming in to rap a sheaf of Whitman on one of Pound's Pison Cantos? And the women channeling Sylvia Plath, Jane Kenyon, Mary Oliver. Think of the night when a table full of beautiful incest survivors do Sharon Olds. That's what poetry can lead to, transformation. That's right, I said. They come in sipping Sauvignon Blanc and they go out quaffing dirty martinis. Now, Augie, don't you see? The potential is unlimited. Sabatini threw his arms into the air in glee. Guys would come down for bachelor parties to perform W.S. Merwin's The Vixen. Sabatini's eyes misted up as he told me about a sergeant down at Rice Street whom he had memorizing Auden, but his joy was short-lived. He leaned against the wall, closed his eyes, and looked troubled. What's the matter, Bobby? I don't know, Augie. Sometimes I wonder why Americans are as afraid of poetry as they are of Al-Qaeda. Screw the ones who've decided that poetry is an effete enterprise. Let them party with the homophobes. It's the others who concern me. The folks who claim they don't get it. Who think they're too dumb to read poetry. Thing is, they're not willing to be dumb enough. That's their problem. If you want to get inside a poem, you need to dumb down to your senses. That's where the receptors are. You need to accept that you don't know. Why should you know? What's the matter with a little mystery? They think the poem's a theorem. If they can't solve it, if they can't control it, then they're afraid of it. It's so American to want it all or nothing. If you can't conquer it, what good is it? Americans have become so frozen with fear they've lost their sense of play. It's time to lighten up and lower our expectations. It's time to rediscover our basic fluency. If a man's not fluent, if he ain't got the flow, what chance does he have to converse with his soul? Consider Jim Moore, the king of fluency, the master of St. Paul in his poem Invisible Strings. I vow to write 7 poems today. Look down and see a crow rising into thick rain on 5th Avenue, as if pulled up by invisible strings, and already there are only 6 to go. That, my friend, is fluency.
That was Bart Schneider, reading from his 2008 book, The Man in the Blizzard. That was the book that introduced us to Private Detective Augie Boyer and his cop friend, Bobby Sabatini, who was addicted to poetry. Hi, I'm Rosemary Manchester, and this is a novel idea. Schneider brings his characters back, and this time, they're right here in Sonoma County, reading poetry, writing haiku, and solving a murder. Suzanne Lang talks with Bart, and we'll listen to that conversation in just a moment. In the second half of the broadcast, we'll feature conversations with Nafisa Haji and Meredith Marin, two of the many authors featured at an upcoming benefit for the Sonoma County Public Library Foundation and for the Book Festival. The event is called Chew on This. So stay tuned. It's a novel idea.
Bart Schneider is an author whose previous work includes Blue Bossa and Beautiful Inez. He's a poet who this past year has released a volume, Morning Opera, and he is the publisher of Kelly's Cove Press, which had a strong and eclectic offering this year, which included a centennial selection of the work of Kenneth Patchen and reintroducing contemporary readers to the writings of Ambrose Bierce. Bart grew up in San Francisco and for the first 30 or so years of his life called Northern California home. Then he moved to Minnesota and stayed for nearly 25, and he's back and brought some of his characters with him. In 2008, Schneider published The Man in the Blizzard, his take on the detective novel, set against the backdrop of the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis. Bobby Sabatini and Augie Boyer return in Nameless Dame, Murder on the Russian River. Sabatini retires to a cabin in Casadero and is about to fulfill his dream of opening a poetry bar, which is located where else but downtown Guerneville.
You love the play of language and the high-low of it, because you really do mix the highbrow and erudite type of thinking and talking with...
Jive, lots of jive, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Is that in your background or just something that you really like?
Well, you know, I think I have an overdeveloped sense of the charlatan, you know, in myself. And, you know, almost all writers and artists have feel like, when are they going to find out about me? But I really feel like that, you know. So you kind of feel like you're some bastard child with the language. And if you have these ideas, you got to dress them down or you're going to seem pretentious, you know, because everybody's really about to find out about you that you don't really know what you're talking about at all.
And maybe that's a perspective that most people have but often don't want to verbalize or admit about themselves. You know, it's funny when I think about what you just said and in relationship to the characters in your book, which I want to get to in a minute, actually. Your characters are the same way, at least in this latest book.
Well, did you think I was talking about me?
Nameless Dame, and it's the first book. I don't know if this is going to be a series, The Man in the Blizzard. Augie Boyer.
Well, it is a series. There's
yes,
two.
There's
right?
two, so it's a series. And there is something about Augie Boyer, who's the private investigator, who's the main character of the book, who has a what I'll call an insecure arrogance about him. I mean, he seems to have this sense of, I don't know, sublime confidence or I don't know. There is something in him that is not quite secure, but he goes ahead anyway.
Sublime confidence, but he knows he's going to get lost in the next cul-de-sac, you know.
Yeah, and is willing to go there anyway.
Which makes for, you know, a nice contradiction in character, you know. So how is somebody like that heroic, you know, or trying to practice heroic deeds when, you know, they don't know where they're going?
Right. Let's just frame the story then. This is a set of characters that started out in not your first book, but your first book of the series, The Man
yeah.
with the Blizzard.
That was a book set in Minnesota against the backdrop of the 2008 Republican convention, and it actually published a couple weeks before the convention. I got everything right, except I never had heard of Sarah Palin. I had Tim Pawlenty being the nomination after he being the VP. But anyway, it was a book with three characters that continue in this book. That's Augie Boyer who tells the story, the detective, and his good buddy Bobby Sabatini, who was a homicide detective for many years with the St. Paul Police Department, but after 9/11 and his prostate problem, he found poetry, and he becomes a poetry evangelist. And in that last novel, that first of the series, he gets everybody to memorize poetry, including FBI people who are looking for code inside certain poems. And the third character is his wife, or the woman who becomes his wife in that novel, who is Blossom, and she was at that time Augie's assistant. She's an ex-con. So they three are now in West County of Sonoma, where Sabatini has retired from the police department and is converting the whole community to memorizing poetry, just as he opens his poetry karaoke bar, Ginsburg's Galley, in the town of Guerneville. And Augie is flying out for the opening.
In some ways, in The Man in the Blizzard, poetry was definitely threaded all through it. But in Nameless Dame, it's just thick with it. And I wonder how your own moving back to California, where you grew up, and being involved with kind of the local scene in a way, infiltrated or informed the book at all.
You know, poetry has been woven through me for a long time. I came up as a poet, and moving back here, I sort of exploded with poetry. That's when I wrote the poems in the book Morning Opera, and I think it was something about moving back suddenly, wow, and getting to live in as beautiful a place as Sonoma, and just after, I love Minnesota. I was there for 25 years, but the idea that you don't have to have a six-month winter every year.
And this year we haven't had a winter at all, so that's the upside, I guess, of global climate change.
Yeah, it is kind of scary.
Yeah. In Nameless Dame, the haiku that is threaded throughout, I will say, distracted me in a good way. At times I was wondering if the story was structured around the haiku. I mean, what your process was, in a way, because I thought, what came first? Because at a certain point, I almost felt the haiku came first.
Yeah, almost always the haiku came right where they came, you know, where I would just kind of think, kind of feels like the dude should be writing a haiku about now, about wrap this little number up. You know, they were those things when you've been writing for so long, you know, you can just, okay, you know, that's like a little 30-second flowerette that you throw out the way somebody that's been decorating their cakes their whole life can just manipulate a flower out of a pastry thing.
And I wonder how you did choose the poets that, the other poets that you threaded through the book. It seems like everybody, literally everybody, no matter their role in the community, was memorizing poems for the opening of the karaoke bar, the poetry karaoke bar, Ginsburg's Galley. And how did you deal with that? How did you choose those poets? Are those some of your favorite lines? Or I imagined you reading stacks and stacks of poetry books.
Yeah, I just kind of felt like, you know, what would Bobby Coolican, the Indian deputy, who would he move towards? And I thought Yeats pretty early on, so I looked through a lot of Yeats that I didn't even know, or that I, you know, that a lot of obscure little poems I didn't know. And, you know, you're looking for small stuff that in some cases can be perfectly apt, in some cases almost thoroughly beside the point, like a non sequitur, you know.
And that's something I do want to mention for our readers, is that it might open up a whole nother line of inquiry in a way. While reading the book, you might find that you are called to do a little additional research and reading on some of these poetry, some of these poems, and I think that that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think the most thrilling part of these books, in a way, for me is getting to weave in the poetry. And it feels like, you know, the last book was meant to be a pretty political book set against the backdrop of the convention. But the most subversive thing about it seemed to be that I was sneaking in these poems, and people were being forced to read poetry, and it went down easily, like dialogue. I mean, dialogue's the easiest thing to read, right? So if you can make poetry go down almost as easily, then, oh, man, you've changed nickel into gold.
And especially with the range of characters, good and shady, who are spouting off poetry. It is undifferentiated that way. Everybody's speaking it. And this book, as you mentioned, is set in the Russian River Valley, a lot of locations that many of our readers have visited or know about, and using some real historical facts of the murder of these two young people on a North Coast beach. And I wonder what your approach to that was, of using real locations and real events, and how you twisted that to your own needs and how you visualized that when you were writing it.
Well, I think it's kind of a delicate deal because, you know, a lot of writers change names, come up with fictive town names, and even change the map. And I don't know why. I've always been drawn to going to as much realistic portrayal of a place. But as I say that, I realize that because it's a real place and real people live there, I'm almost forced to turn it part into a cartoon landscape and really make a point of reminding myself, okay, you're calling that town Grayton, and you're having certain things happen in Grayton, and certain things come from Forestville. But it's fiction, you know, and you get to do whatever you want to do inside. I'm saying this is a world I imagine. It happens to be have these same towns as the real West County does. But imagine if this happened here. Not that it did happen.
There are so many writers right now, actually, who have books out set in Sonoma County. They set their books in Sonoma County, but as you said, they redrew the map a little bit. So in some ways it was very familiar, and in other ways it was disorienting, because I know she means this town, but it's really called this town, you know, and kind of to protect the innocent, maybe. And so when I was reading your book and encountering these real places, I had a different reaction, but still wondering, where?
What was your reaction?
Actually, wanting to pinpoint the locations even more, you know, and where is this on Main Street in Guerneville? Or, you know, so I could visualize it more, though, so I think it was in these other books, I was trying to relate the fictional places with the real places. And in your book, I found that I was had more of a real backdrop.
And how does that affect the way you see the figures, the characters in the landscape of the town?
You know, it made me wonder about the people that inhabit these places, and maybe things we don't know about what's right before our eyes. For instance, the place in Jenner, I'm assuming it's a place I've been many times, and the bar there. And yet there was a fictional spin to it. So I have what's going on, my pre-knowledge, that not all readers are going to have. I mean, you're going to have a much wider readership than those people who are just residents of Sonoma County. But knowing these places, it's an added bit of fun, actually, that we know these places. And it made me wonder about what I was missing of inside information in the book The Man in the Blizzard that was set in a part of the country I've never been to. So I don't know. Just it had me going.
Those places really resonate. And I think some people expect the people, some readers expect the people to be real too, that they're all based on somebody. If they're not actually the person, a caricature of the person or something, but
have you had people ask you about that?
People ask me about that all the time.
Like, who is he supposed to really be?
Yeah, and I never feel like any. I mean, if anything, you know, I really believe that it's like one way of looking at our dreams that that every character in your dream is just some aspect of yourself. And, you know, as the writer, I kind of feel like all the characters are some aspect of me, but I'm not looking at anybody out in the world when I'm thinking of a character. Because it's such a, you know, I might take a mustache from somebody that or something, but I like the psychology even to almost grow itself organically as I'm building the character and not to have somebody else's baggage. I want to create their baggage.
Yet, and I would like you to address this using of the real situation of a murder that many of our listeners will remember that happened on the North Coast. That got my attention.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one place where I felt like I was maybe in over my head a little bit. It's a real painful tragedy that did happen on the Sonoma coast and that wasn't solved. It hasn't been solved. And I refer to that and maybe in too cavalier a way, I don't know. You know, I mean, that's what I felt. I felt, but I had to let the characters do what they were going to do with it.
Well, you know, in some ways, I was at first taken aback a little bit and then, well, it is part of the lore of the area. I mean, when something like that happens someplace, an unsolved crime, that's what the genre you're writing in deals with.
And so the fact that this murder that takes place in my novel may be a copycat of that or not is that's certainly relevant, you know, and you know, people's frustrations go, they don't die with something like that.
Right, right. Something that I also noticed that you just mentioned in your book, The Man in the Blizzard, was set against the backdrop of the convention in 2008, right? And Nameless Dame has a very contemporary, immediate feel as well with the Occupy 99%, and it was something that drew me in, that you were writing in the now.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I really tried to do it with the last book, so I backed off that a little bit in this book because I felt like I was pushing it. I had to have that, you know, my last text in for that about 3 months before it was publishing, which was, I was writing about the events before they happened. But this one, you know, it's, you do get to write pretty close to, I mean, if you have a nimble publisher, you get to write pretty close to the deadline. I mean, if I say up to 3 months or something, I think it was like that with this. So if it's a contemporary novel, I mean, what an opportunity to get to use the stuff where it seems relevant to your story and frame it to have that much more resonance.
So we're talking with Bart Snyder about his latest novel, Nameless Dame, Murder on the Russian River, a story featuring Augie Boyer, the private investigator, and his buddy Bobby Sabatini, who's opening up a poetry karaoke bar in Guerneville. And
I love the way you said that, and you just smiled like it's such an absurd idea.
Well, I don't know that it is an absurd idea in a place like Sonoma County, where we actually are thick with poets and readings all over the place. And so I maybe I'm smiling more out of delight. One other thing I guess I did want to talk with you about last time we had a conversation was about your publishing endeavor, and I was wondering if there was anything more you wanted to let us know about that.
Well, I'm starting to develop next year's list. I probably have 5 books come out in the fall, and one of them is by a book of stories by Dan Koshner, the Guerneville writer, really great story writer, whose first book of stories, Occupations and Other Preoccupations, won the Willa Cather Award for short stories back quite a few years ago now. So it's really, I feel really lucky to get the opportunity to publish him. And he has some really relevant stories of the moment, I think, in terms of, you talk about the 99.
Very good. Very good. And I think that we're very fortunate that you have moved back to Northern California and that you're contributing to our rich environment here.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for coming in today.
Pleasure.
That was Suzanne Lang in conversation with Bart Schneider about his latest novel, Nameless Dame, Murder on the Russian River. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. When we come back, you'll hear from Meredith Marin with her latest book called A Theory of Small Earthquakes, and Nafisa Haji with The Sweetness of Tears. And then author Barbara Quick will be here with her review of Zona by Jeff Dyer. We'll be right back. Manchester, and this is a novel idea. The mission of the Sonoma County Public Library Foundation is to strengthen the ability of the Sonoma County Library to serve the community by raising funds to support the library and to promote the use of library resources, enthusiasm for reading, and increased literacy for all Sonoma County residents. To that end, they host an annual benefit full of good food, good wine, and great authors. It's a chance for you to meet and greet some of the best the Bay Area has to offer. This year, some of the featured writers you've heard here in the past and will hear more of in the future: Stacy Carlson, Joan Frank, Sari Prince Halverson, Frederick Wiesel, Carolyn Burke, to name a few. And among them is Meredith Marin and Nafisa Haji. Let's listen to Suzanne's conversation with these authors. Chew on This is held at the Central Branch of the Library and will take place on April 21st. For more information, you can go online to www.scplf.com. That's for Sonoma County Public Library Foundation.
Meredith Marin is a writer. You may have encountered her work in magazines everywhere from People to Mother Jones to Family Circle. She's written 10 or so nonfiction books that in most cases tell a story that maybe not too many other people were addressing. How would you feel if your dad was gay? Dirty, A Search for Answers Inside America's Teen Drug Epidemic. And My Lie, A True Story of False Memory. And here we talk about her recently published work of fiction, A Theory of Small Earthquakes.
You seem to be a prolific writer, and with lots of articles and lots of books, some of which are, I don't know if you would call them memoirs, but seem to be culture and filtered through your own experience. And now this looks to be your first novel. I'm wondering what has brought this change in your life as a writer?
First of all, I've always wanted to write a novel, and this is by far not my first novel. It's just my first publishable novel. I've written several over the years, starting when I was about 19, and it was just very hard for me to do it well enough to tell anybody I was doing it. It was a lifelong goal that I finally achieved at age 60, and apart from that, I got to a point with my nonfiction, which, as you say, was some memoir and some journalism in terms of the books I wrote. I also do a lot of magazine and newspaper work, but I got to a point where I felt like the message I was trying to convey was becoming too heavy-handed, that it wasn't allowing enough room for the reader to sort of interpret things for herself or himself. And I felt like to tell the fairly complex and very sexy and very reflective story I wanted to tell about these characters, I felt that making it up would go over better.
A Theory of Small Earthquakes, it's struck me as both a cultural history of Berkeley and Oakland over the past 20 some years.
Right.
And I mean, that was a real strong backdrop to the story. And then the story was an exploration, really, I mean, in my mind, of love and sexual pleasure and identity and how these things relate to being a parent, a lover, a friend.
Right.
I mean, how did you come up with that, this relationship of Allison and her desire to be a mother, but her, in some ways, inability to deal with her own truths.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to put it. The story was actually based on a true story. A friend of mine told me this story about 10 years ago, a couple years before I started writing the novel, about having been lovers with a woman, first same-sex relationship for both of them, and after about 7 or 8 years, the other woman had decided she wanted to be a mom. And this, like my book, this started in the 80s. And she felt that she would be doing great harm to her children to raise children with another woman. So she left my friend for a man and ended up having a child with him. And my friend, who was her ex-lover, was and still is very involved with the children of that marriage, in part because she felt like they were in some way hers. They were the children she would have had if the world were a kinder place to lesbian moms.
And that is a central conflict in this book. And also at the heart of it is how the main character, Allison, deals with this situation is largely through maintaining secrets or lack of disclosure to both the father and then asking her former lover to abide by that.
Right. It's basically the arrangement that they make, Allison, her then ex-lover Zoe, and the man with whom she's raising the child, Mark. It's really a whole overlapping series of blackmail episodes. And you know, that sounds really harsh when put that way, but I think in real life, that's kind of the exchange that we have all the time in our relationships. You know, if you unload the dishwasher, I'll be in a better mood and more likely to have sex with you tonight, or, you know, or any other little social interaction between friends. You know, it's give and take, but it's all some sort of exchange. And so Zoe very much wants to be a mother, another mother to this child. And she has no legal claim on the child, and whose name is Corey. And so the only way that she can get what she wants, which is to be in Corey's life, is to negotiate a kind of agreement with Allison and with her man, Mark.
And you're right, that is something that in our own lives, I think sometimes that's on a daily basis, that's how we get by. However, in your book, it was so clear, the trade-offs and compromises, and as a reader, it left me with a sense of discomfort. And that may be sometimes in our own lives we squelch or justify somehow. And I couldn't help but to feel that that was part of what you were eliciting.
Well, I was going for that for sure. I think the character of Allison, who one thing I'd love to mention is the fact that the book was rejected many, many times by lots of editors. And the reason they gave was that they didn't like Allison. And I did rewrite the book a bazillion times. And so she's a little, I think, not necessarily more likable, but a little bit more understandable now than she was before. But the main point that I was trying to sort of bring across in the character of Allison is that she is thinking and saying and doing things that we all think but don't necessarily say or do. So this exchange I'm talking about, a power struggle, or just a power balance, or our attempt to keep power balances in all of our relationships, lovers and friends and kids, normally takes place under the surface. And with Allison, everything except the truth is very much brought to the surface.
Well, and you had an interesting way of handling this in the book, just in the structure of your book. It was definitely written from Allison's perspective, mm-hmm. yet you did have this third-person narration, yet you did hear Allison's thoughts now and then.
Right. Yes. That was one of the things it was very tricky to do, especially being a first time novelist, I wanted the reader to know what Allison was thinking and to see the contrast between, what she thought and what she said. And it was difficult to pull off in a way because one of the things I edited out in one of the bazillion drafts was there was far too much of Allison thinking yes and then saying no, or, you know, Allison saying, of course I will, and then the reader knowing she's lying. So I had to make it subtle enough that it wasn't obnoxious, but yet I really wanted us to all consider the times that someone says, my book is going on the New York Times list, and you say, oh, I'm so happy for you, and it's a lie.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
At least it's a partial truth, you know. And in my own life, I attempt to negotiate that thin line, and that happens to be a very apt example because I have friends who get on the New York Times list all the time, and I am happy for them, and I'm also horribly envious, and so I try to diffuse it by just saying, I'm so happy for you and I'm horribly envious, and then send them flowers.
Well, that's a good way to deal with it. And I hope people have sent you flowers as well for the publication of your book. Yes. No, I thought that was an effective way of standing outside of the characters, for the reader to stand outside of them, but then to hear Allison's kind of back voice and to experience the insecurity that really runs a lot of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to follow up with something in setting up our conversation today, and you had mentioned something in one of our emails. Did the end of the story make me mad? And without giving mm-hmm. too much away about the story, or about the ending, because I think sometimes readers like to arrive to that point themselves. That you asked that question made me think that that was some feedback you were getting.
Absolutely. And, people tend to be very passionate about the ending. And, of course, we're not going to reveal it here. But I'd say 90% of people really like it because they see the ways in which it reflects real life. And 10% of people say, you know, they want something else and they feel frustrated by it. So if I had written a novel that, you know, or if the goal of my writing a novel was to have people put the book down with a very self-satisfied, smug smile on their faces, I would have written a very different novel and certainly a different ending. But the point of this was to leave people feeling and thinking and examining the ways in which they would have handled the situations that Allison got herself into.
I just wanted to get back to the point of you said an observation, at least from one of your editors in an earlier draft, that they didn't like Allison or that she wasn't a likable character.
Mm-hmm.
And I have noticed in several contemporary novels that I've read recently, and some of the authors we've talked to, Joan Frank and Ceree Prince Halverson, have characters in their books who aren't always likable. And I think that that's in some ways a daring thing to do in a book, because that is mirroring and reflecting our interactions on a daily basis.
Well, it's also a hugely political issue. And I don't know if you happen to read Meg Wolitzer, the novelist Meg Wolitzer wrote a piece in a recent issue of the New York Times Book Review called The Second Shelf, and she talks about the ways in which female authors are treated so differently from male authors, and how when women write stories, family stories, they're called small or quiet, and when men do it, you know, there's a big splash made, and it's all taken a lot more seriously. And I actually just wrote a letter to the New York Times in response, and I have about 90 women writers who signed it with me, supporting her point of view and also mentioning the fact that so often when we write women characters who aren't nice and who don't end up either having no fun at all or having fun and regretting it and having to do penance for it, that people say that, you know, the character isn't sympathetic. And yet male characters in books, and especially male characters written by male authors, are given so much more leeway to be such jerks. You could say that reflects real life, but I really don't think that's the reason for it. I think in the same way that a female boss who's strict and businesslike is referred to by a certain word starting with a B, and a male boss who's exactly the same is referred to as a boss.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you're out there and so many other strong women writers right now who are pushing it and producing novels that are highly readable and engaging and challenging. And isn't
that
what we want?
Well, thanks for saying that. I think it's the readers, too. I give readers a lot of credit because ultimately I think what publishers think of readers has a lot to do with what gets published and therefore what readers get to think about. And I think readers have been clamoring for real characters and really, you know, complex stories and sexy stories for a long time. And some of the books that are being published now are reflecting that finally, which is great.
I think it's great, too. And we're happy that you're coming back to Sonoma County soon.
That's right.
For the Chew On This event. And
that's
I wonder, are you, since it's taken you these years to come up with your first novel, what's your second one? Is that in the works as well?
Oh, it's about half done. And, you know, knock on formica, it will not take 8 years to see the light of day. But I'm finding it a lot easier so far to write the second one than I did the first one. And having published the first one and having gotten some great reviews, I think I'll have a little bit of an easier time publishing it. I'm also publishing another nonfiction book in January with Penguin, and that book is called Why We Write. And for that book, I interviewed 20 very commercially successful American authors about how writing feels to them, why they do it, how they do it, and what their tips are for writers who are coming up.
Thanks a lot, Meredith. I'm glad that this worked out for us to
talk today. Me too,
Suzanne.
I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
I'm Suzanne Lang, and you've been listening to my conversation with Meredith Marin on her recently published novel, A Theory of Small Earthquakes. It's a novel idea. Stay with us. Nafisa Haji, like many of us, is the child of immigrants. Her parents migrated from Bombay to Karachi, Pakistan, and finally to the United States shortly before Nafisa was born. She has spent a good deal of her life in California, but frequently travels to Pakistan and is rooted in her Sufi culture. Nafisa's first book, The Writing on Her Forehead, is the story of a Muslim American of Indo-Pakistani descent, and it was nominated for a Northern California Independent Booksellers Association Book of the Year Award. Her just-released book is The Sweetness of Tears, the story of a young woman's quest to discover who she is in the world, in her family, and it takes her on a journey through language and religion and culture, all set against the war on terror. I spoke with Nafisa Haji at the River Reader in Guerneville, California, where she was giving a reading. The main character in The Sweetness of Tears is named Joe March. Of course, Joe March is the protagonist of Little Women and a role model to many a reader. I asked Nafisa simply, why Joe March?
Early on in the book, that's what came out of my fingers as I was typing along and thinking, that'll probably have to change. Yeah, that won't stay. And then as the themes of the book unfolded, it wasn't necessarily in the character of Joe March that I explored sort of my idea of the issues of Joe March, the original. It was in characters around her. And one of the things that I, in revisiting Little Women, that I came across more strongly than ever because I was looking for it, I think, was the whole question of gender. If you know, everyone who loves Little Women will remember how Jo was constantly being chided for putting her hands in her pocket, for whistling, for wearing boots and marching around instead of being feminine and dainty the way that her society expected her to be. And much of the things that she gets chided about are not issues that we have today, ironically enough. But now we still live in a place where a little boy getting his toenails painted pink by his mom creates a ruckus in the media and a conversation about what this means and gender expectations more for boys than for girls in some ways. Not that the issues for women are gone or solved. They're not. But in terms of these little things, these mannerism issues, they're more of issues for boys than they are for girls, I think, oftentimes. And so some of the things that I was trying to explore were about that world, that separation of feminine and masculine, and how they play out in culture, and what happens when masculinity is severed from femininity, and what happens when there's a gender imbalance in a society either enforced through religious mores or even legal traditions, and how really everyone suffers when that happens. So Joe is there as a character, as the voice of the novel in terms of exploring and taking us to these places, as the guide, as the storyteller, the way that Joe March is a writer. But she's not where the issues of Little Women get replayed in that sense, in that gender sense of what I remembered from Little Women.
Did you reread Little Women?
I didn't while I was writing it, because I felt like I had a pretty vivid memory. But talking about the whole pink toenails and little boys issue, my son is 11, and we're doing it as a read-aloud right now. And I take every opportunity to inflict my taste on him or what I think would be good for him. And I know that's not a book that he would have ever picked up on his own. It's a funny thing, because it did feel like I'm reading a girl's book to him. But it's been wonderful. I think he's enjoyed it, and I think more men should read Little Women.
In talking about that you name your character Joe March, and that there's literary threads running through Little Women, and that you are pulling that through your book and adding on to it.
I can date the time that I first said, I want to be a writer, to Jo sitting in her garret with her apples, sharing space with the rat or the mouse or whatever it was. Absolutely. And the idea of a woman, a young woman at a time of crisis in her country, sort of empowering herself through the word and through the use of it and through writing it down and all of that, I can relate to. And yeah, Jo March is why I wanted to be a writer. And, you know, I look back on it, and a lot of the issues are so interesting because I was given Little Women by my mom. And in the reread now with my son, it occurs to me how she read it growing up in a country far, far away with a faith very different. And this is a book that is rich with religious metaphors, specifically Protestant Christian metaphors, Little Women, and what how they must have struck my mom and all the friends that she had. They all read it, apparently. It's an international book. And so what does it say about that book, that it speaks across faiths and cultures and unfortunately just not gender, apparently. But yeah, absolutely, Jo is a hero.
Your books are very much this intercultural experience, and I am seeing that a lot in literature right now, and not necessarily because it's a trend, it's because who we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something I talk about a lot. I think post 9/11, a book became a bestseller that was an academic, at least in terms of popular culture, was definitely more obscure, The Clash of Civilizations. And right from the beginning, even the title and the image of the title was one I always had a problem with, because it sort of represented culture and civilizations as these solid things that can, you know, oops, bump up against each other on a freeway with catastrophic results. They're solid vehicles that can cause death when they collide. And my experience of life has always been intercultural. To me, culture is fluid, and it's always been fun to, in one lifetime, to watch how culture goes from one place to the next and back again. And the best metaphor for me is food. Since I've grown up, how much more ethnic food is available in the United States, but more than that, how much more ethnic food is available everywhere, multiplicities of it, and how the food changes when it migrates. I mean, we all know some of the examples of how, you know, some of the foods that we get in Chinese restaurants here are not available in China, apparently, but I bet you they are now because they got re-exported from here back home and back to China. Politically, you know, I study history, so the issue of the image of the melting pot of America was always something that people on the sort of progressive end of things didn't like, that analogy, because it implied assimilation and melting, and that means everybody has to melt into one, and there was an objection. And I remember a movement to sort of, you know, at least in terms of academia, to change the melting pot to the salad bowl, so everybody gets to keep their flavor and still mix. And that was a lovely thought, but it really, to me, now that I look back on it, it is a melting pot, and it's not just the United States, it's the entire world. So for good or for bad, we change each other when we encounter each other, mostly for good, when given enough time. Recipes take time, some more than others, and sometimes we are quick to judge things before they're done cooking. So you have to wait till it's done. We're such impatient creatures, human beings. And as I get older, I look at things differently. And my impatience for certain things are good. I think we should be impatient for justice, and we should be impatient for better outcomes for the earth or what have you, especially because the earth is, you know, in terms of certain things, there are deadlines that we have to meet. But when you take the long view of things and look at it, you know, we talk about the slow food movement. We should think about the slow history movement. And I love traveling. And whenever I travel around Europe, and I'm a big fan of history, I can't get over the fact that really 60 some odd years ago, what kind of upheaval Europe was in, what kind of mass murder was taking place in Germany, the kind of horror that we can't even begin to really imagine, no matter how much you read about it. An entire group of people attempted extermination, in addition to horrific acts of war, bombings. I mean, it was really not that war. It was the first war, World War, that started it. But the whole idea of modern warfare and being able to drop bombs from the air and annihilate peoples below all of those horrors, and now you look around Europe and it's a lovely, peaceful, wonderful place to visit, and it's happened in one lifetime. So that gives me hope when I look at the parts of the world that that I visit often, Pakistan, and I see similar kinds of upheaval, horrors, crimes against minorities, women treated in ways that no human being should even contemplate treating another human being. And I think that we have to work hard and be impatient in terms of our actions, but I also take heart in the fact that in 60 years it could look totally different.
And maybe it is books like your books, The Writing on Her Forehead and The Sweetness of Tears, that will help break down barriers and open up ways of thinking.
I think that books in general will. I think it slows us down when we read.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was part of the conversation I had with Nafisa Hadji in the back of Susan Ryan's bookstore, The River Reader, in Guerneville, California.
Thanks, Suzanne. You can meet Meredith Marin and Nafisa Hadji in person at Chew on This, an evening with writers to benefit our public libraries and the Sonoma County Book Festival.
And Rosemary, now let's hear from author and regular contributor to A Novel Idea, Barbara Quick, with her review of Jeff Dyer's Zona.
More often than not, I have an allergic reaction to the very idea of things best described as postmodern. Not so with Zona, the highly touted new book by British novelist Jeff Dyer. Postmodern in every sense of the phrase, Zona proclaims itself in the subtitle to be a book about a film, about a journey to a room. Oh, give me a break, I thought when I first saw the cover. The film in question is the cult favorite Stalker, made by Andrei Tarkovsky in 1979. I had never heard of Stalker before I read Zona, but now I'm determined to see it. Many other people besides Jeff Dyer swear by this film as a consummate work of art, from Ingmar Bergman to Kate Blanchett, who said, "Every single frame is burned into my retina." Zona not only regales the reader with a scene-by-scene description of Stalker, it is also, much more importantly, the story of Jeff Dyer's obsession with the film. Unlike so many works in the postmodern genre, Zona engages us at a thoroughly human and often comical level. It is, apart from its nominal subject, a journey into the fascinating mind of its author. The book is crazily, and I must say delightfully, discursive, with footnotes that often take up more real estate on the page than the main text of the book itself. In the manner of so many other British writers, Jeff Dyer has a dazzling command of our language, an enviable education, and delicious sense of irony. Even his footnotes are fun to read. The loopy relationship between the footnotes and the text makes us feel like a guest at some kind of dream dinner party where the conversation wanders all over the map but is always witty and exciting. Quite apart from the reading public's awareness of Stalker or anyone's intention to see it, Jeff Dyer's tribute to the film may well become a cult favorite all on its own. I'm Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Remember, you can listen to A Novel Idea whenever you want on our podcast at www.krcb.org. I'm Rosemary Manchester.
And I'm Suzanne Lang.
And remember, there's no such thing as too many books. Thank you.